This week on Wealth Track, award-winning financial planner Mark Rattazzo on the extreme danger of portfolio volatility in retirement. He is next on Consuelo Mack Wealth Track. Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. Our focus this week, the challenge facing most of us, not running out of money in retirement. Nobel Prize winning behavioral economist Richard Thaler recently called the drawing down of money in retirement way harder than the saving phase because of the uncertainty of how long we will live. He is proposing adding 401k funds to Social Security to increase monthly payouts. This week's guest wholeheartedly agrees with Thaler about the difficulty of the spend-down phase and says another largely unrecognized danger is portfolio volatility, which can mean the difference between solvency and insolvency at the end of life. He has the research to prove it. He is Mark Rattazzo, a certified financial planner, founder and senior partner of Macro Consulting Group, an independent wealth management firm established in 1992. Forbes recognized Rattazzo as one of America's top wealth advisors, and he has been named a Barron's top advisor for 9 years, among many other recognitions. He is also a Wealth Track regular. Rattazzo has done a number of studies showing how the accumulation phase of investing assets for retirement, if done regularly and systematically over many years, can make just about anyone feel like a genius. However, once the withdrawals begin, what the pros call the decumulation phase, it's a whole different ballgame. What works so well in building up a nest egg can be a disaster when taking it apart.
The accumulation phase isn't timing dependent. It's time dependent. So if you are, we did studies going back over 90 years and looked at if you put money away every month, regardless of when you started, your compounded rate of return over long periods of time of what you would expect and what you received, even if your timing was very bad, bottom 5% of timing on when you started doing that, mm-hmm. but you did it for the same period of time.
We're assuming 30 years.
A 30-year period of time. If you dollar cost averaged $5,000 a month into the market, and we started back in the 20s, and we started in February, went forward 30 years, March 30 years. So we have hundreds of 30-year periods mm-hmm. that we looked at.
Right.
Your expected rate of return was about 11% in the middle.
If you and for those of us out there who are saying that, no, that's way too high. You're saying no. This is the 11% return is from dollar cost averaging, right. The compounding effect,
yes.
Total return,
yeah. So
everything, right?
Long term buying and just holding stocks over that 90 plus year period of time was for blue chip stocks was about 10% a year.
Yeah.
So you actually got a little bit of enhanced performance by buying when the markets had those dips and enhanced right. your performance because you had multiple entry points.
So that's still a reasonable expectation for a 30 year period of time.
Yeah. 30-year period of time.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. If you're dollar cost averaging in.
Right.
So if you had terrible timing and you started and it was the bottom 5% of all of these hundreds and hundreds of periods we observed, mm-hmm. you still did 8.5% a year compounded rate of return on your money.
When you're talking about the bottom 5% as far as you know timing is concerned,
yeah.
that's when you're buying at market highs.
Correct.
Right.
You bought, and we looked at all of the hundreds of different 30-year periods. We ranked them, and we looked at the bottom 5%. So, like, you know, got in terrible timing, but you consistently put the money away. Mm-hmm. You were a disciplined investor. You had that, you know, fortitude to keep plowing the money in. You still averaged 8.5% a year. Mm-hmm. And what happens with accumulators is I think that they get lulled into this false sense of security that they were a great investor, you know, or that they had this great experience or they were lucky. And it was their fortitude and their discipline mm-hmm. to continue doing it that gave them a great experience. So,
well, it actually, and that's accurate.
Yes.
You know, right, discipline, consistent, automatic investing. Over a 30-year period, you come out of the other end, no matter kind of ways you said what you did, when you started or whatever.
I will tell you that
you do okay.
It Correct.
Right.
And so people come to us who were good investors.
Right.
You know, my investment's five times what I put in. I put in $1.8 million, $5,000 a month for 30 years, and my account value is $8 million. Mm-hmm. I did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You did a terrible job relative. You didn't do a terrible job. Your timing was terrible. And you actually had a very low percentage experience relative to others, but it still was a great experience.
Right.
And the number that knocked my socks off was the worst 30-year period. The Depression, 73, 74 correction, 08 crash, still did 6.5% a year, mm-hmm. compounded rate of return,
mm-hmm.
better than inflation, better than bonds, just do it.
Right.
The gotcha. Worst, the worst out of all of the hundreds and hundreds of 30-year periods we observed.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So the message, right, for people who are in the accumulation phase is just do it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
And no matter what's happening, put your blinders on, put your headphones on, and just do
it. Just keep investing.
Yes.
But the fact is that there is a certain amount of hubris that when you're dealing with the accumulators who have had such a great experience...
Right.
in accumulating their assets and savings for retirement. So what are the biggest mistakes that they make in making the transition from the accumulation phase, the transition to retirement, where they're actually taking money out of all of those funds that they've accumulated?
They think the things that were additive and beneficial as an accumulator will be additive and beneficial as a decumulator, and it couldn't be further apart.
So what are the things that are beneficial to you as an accumulator that are harmful to you as you start withdrawing funds from your portfolio?
So volatility and time were their friend as an accumulator.
Right.
And volatility and time become their enemy as a decumulator. So the longer I'm putting that money in, the more likelihood I'm going to get close to that long-term expected rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
And the more volatility I have, I'm buying on more severe swings, it actually enhances that performance. As a decumulator, volatility is your enemy. So the sequence that performance occurs and timing and volatility are critical to your outcome as a decumulator, and time becomes your enemy. The longer you're retired, the greater the probabilities that you'll run out of money. The longer you invest as an accumulator, the better your outcome and your probability of a good outcome is going to be. So it is literally 180 degrees that
right.
the things that are most helpful and beneficial and that helped you succeed to create money, create wealth, when you start drawing down from it, and especially if you have a reasonable withdrawal rate, those are things that can be very, very devastating to the spectrum of your outcome.
So the market will be volatile.
Yes.
Therefore, why is volatility so harmful as you are making these with monthly withdrawals from your retirement account?
So we did an analysis of somebody who had a 60-40 mix of stocks to bonds, and they indexed. So, you know, we're just going to use market performance, market volatility,
right.
no fees, you know, to make it easy.
And that shouldn't be as volatile a portfolio as a straight in stocks.
Correct. And I think people that are getting close to retirement, they want some fixed income to have that. So that, you know, balanced to moderate growth portfolio is very, very common what we see.
Right.
So if you are taking a 5% withdrawal rate, you had $1 million, you're taking out $50,000 a year, your expected chance of running out of money during a 30-year retirement is only about 10%. Okay? It's very manageable risk. And even those chances of running out of money are pretty deep into retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a little bit of a hit to your portfolio, like we experienced this last December, you know, and a 60-40 portfolio goes from $1 million down to $850,000, a 15% hit. That happens frequently,
mm-hmm.
not an 08 devastation or the depression that, you know, the thing that everyone's afraid of isn't the thing that's the greatest risk to them or the probability of the mm-hmm. greatest risk to them. Little bit of a hit, $850,000 starting value, and you still need that same $50,000 a year.
Right.
The fact that the market dropped the day, the month, the year before you retired
mm-hmm.
and brought your portfolio down to 850, I was planning on needing 50 grand a year during my retirement. Your chance of running out of money goes from about 10% to more than 30% chance you'll run out of money during your retirement.
Wow, just with that
15%. Little bit of volatility on the front end triples
mm-hmm.
your chance of you running out of money during retirement.
We've all been encouraged to do, you know, automatic savings, dollar cost averaging, you know, put the same amount in every month, whatever it is. You can't just flip that and say, okay, from now on, I'm going to take the same amount of money automatically out of my account every month, regardless of market circumstances. It doesn't work that way.
Correct.
So what does work? How do you handle the market volatility?
So there are a lot of different things that people can do. And it really is what sacrifices are you willing to make if there's mm-hmm. a problem. And so it may be that if the market corrects right before you're about to retire, you work another year or two if you are able to. Mm-hmm. It may be that if in the first few years, it's those first 5 years of retirement, the first few years before retirement, the first 5 years into retirement,
that are
really,
critical.
Really going to set the trajectory on everything. Mm-hmm. If you get when the markets go up on average, go back the last 90 years, the average up market's 21% up and the average down market's 6% down. So mm-hmm. you're going to know, did you get a fast start and you're ahead of schedule where now your withdrawal rate's a lower percentage and you have a much safer probability of not running out, you have less time, mm-hmm. and you have a lower percentage, you're in great shape. Go live your life, enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. If you have a hit, and now it's having that discussion before you retire, what are you willing to do? Maybe it's work part-time and make $25,000 a year where you're mm-hmm. only drawing 25 from the portfolio, not the full 50. Maybe it's you're willing to use the equity in your home mm-hmm. if you get to that point where you realize you're going to have a higher probability of running out of money, and maybe I'm willing to sacrifice and use the equity in my home later on. And those are all triggers and things that if you have them available to you, you at least are making deliberate decisions. It's like a fire drill. If the building caught on fire right now, what would you do? I'd grab this important thing and that important mm-hmm. thing, and here's my exit. Hopefully, we're never going to need to execute on that, but while the building's on fire, after I told you the building's on fire, I ask you, what are you going to do? You know, it's not going to be as effective of conversation because it's going to be very emotionally driven mm-hmm. as opposed to practical on what are the things I'm willing to do. It may be annuitizing some of your money. Morningstar did a great study. If you annuitize a small piece of your portfolio, it was about a quarter or less than a quarter of your portfolio, mm-hmm. it gives you an outsized cash flow relative to what you would normally withdraw.
Right, and this is throughout retirement, for instance. Just
correct.
Have an annuity as part of your portfolio,
yeah,
retirement
portfolio. You took a little bit of your money and you said, I'm going to convert this principal into a cash flow for the rest of
right.
my life for a small piece.
Right.
It takes the withdrawal rate on the rest of your portfolio down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And the longer you live, the greater the rate of return is on that annuity because you're getting payments for a longer and longer period of time. Very nice natural hedge. The really interesting thing about the study was, since I'm not taking as much money from the stock part of my portfolio, mm-hmm. it allows that to, even though it's a smaller amount to start with, it compounds at a greater rate because I'm not drawing as much from the stocks over a longer period of time. It actually has a greater ending value, expected ending value, and a lower chance of running out of money. It's less risk with a higher expected return. That doesn't happen often when you're, you know, investing, that you
right.
get a lower risk mm-hmm. with a higher
mm-hmm.
return.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is that honest conversation. Some people aren't willing to do that. Maybe they build a bond ladder mm-hmm. and they can say, that will buy me time mm-hmm. if the market's down. I've got 5 years worth of income that I can use to draw. But it really is, and you know, we've had our last couple of major bear markets have recovered within that window of time.
Right.
And it prevented you from being forced to sell stocks at the wrong time. Having a ladder, you know, if you need $50,000 a year and we build a portfolio that has $50,000 of bonds coming due every year for a 5 year period,
right.
if the market's up, we sell from the profit and we take that bond that's coming due and we put it at the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And we always have 5 years worth of time that we've bought ourselves
I see.
With that strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all mitigators. They all have their pros and cons.
Right.
You know, and it really is modeling this to that client's risk willingness and ability to take risk and what their preferences are.
How do we have a portfolio that will adapt to market declines? Because we will go through market declines
right.
throughout our retirement.
Yeah, and what we're not trying to time the market. We're
yeah.
trying to have alternatives to being forced to sell equities when they're depressed. When you're drawing from the portfolio, because the market gets hit and I sell shares of the stock market to pay my property tax or to eat or to
right.
for living expenses, when the market subsequently goes up, those shares don't participate.
Right.
So it's not a timing thing where I've got that money to go back in. It's a I've exhausted that resource. Mm-hmm. It's a permanent destruction of capital at that point.
So you want to make sure that you're always invested in the stock market, which is where your growth's going to be, that a portion of your portfolio should be invested in the stock market no matter what.
Correct.
So, you know, therefore, I'm thinking to myself, well, then I should probably have a substantial portion of my portfolio that's not in the stock market, like a bond ladder, but then I'm sacrificing the growth that would be, you know, normally in the stock portfolio. So how do you adjust to that?
So if you're selling from profits, if the markets are up and they're exceeding your expected rate of return or your projection, and
right,
you're selling excess, then that's easy. You know, what you're trying to do is prevent the market hit and your withdrawal compounding that hit to your principal on the growth engine part
right,
of your portfolio.
Right.
So that's why having the ladder, and maybe you take it from your normal fixed income. Maybe your 60-40 portfolio mm-hmm. becomes a 70-30, and instead of having that fixed income as part of your overall allocation, we carve that out, and that is its own separate account. That's a liability match mm-hmm. part mm-hmm. of your portfolio. And also the equities that you're in, making sure that the types of portfolios that you're investing in produce good risk-adjusted rates of return. The same rate of return with lower volatility. Surprisingly, even in accumulation, mm-hmm. portfolios that have the same net compounded rate of return with lower volatility, the majority of the time produce a higher ending expected value. There's a small percentage of the time uh-huh. where you get an outsized performance from the high volatility one, but it's very small and not worth, you know, betting your outcome on.
Right. The volatility, dampening volatility, which people normally think, gee, if I'm dampening volatility, those are probably more defensive issues, and the upside's not going to be as great. I'm sacrificing performance.
Yeah.
You're saying not the case.
Not the case.
Okay.
You know, we run a dividend portfolio.
Right. So tell me about you. So you have a strategy that you've been running since 2012 for separate accounts mm-hmm. called the macro dividend strategy, mm-hmm. right? That's been ranked very highly by Morningstar.
Yeah.
So how does that work? You know, what is that strategy and what's it doing in your portfolios? How is it behaving in your portfolios?
So relative to its benchmarks, mm-hmm. it has produced volatility that's 20% less volatile than the S&P or its value
the
benchmark.
The Russell 1000 value is right. its benchmark, right, in the S&P.
Mm-hmm. And it's produced returns that were in excess of those
right.
two indices. And what that means to you as an investor, we ran numbers on the stock market long-term performance with its average volatility, mm-hmm. drawing 5% from that portfolio, 20% chance you'll run out of money. Same expected rate of return with 20% less volatility, you cut your chance of running out of money in half.
So what, to 10%?
To 10%.
After 30 years?
Versus 20.
There are a lot of dividend strategies
sure.
out there.
So
what kind of a dividend strategy?
We generally buy quality companies. You know, our portfolio in 2018 was down less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And the value index was down about 9 mm-hmm. on the S&P, several percentage points, obviously.
Right.
So we buy companies that are earning more than their dividend, generally have good financials, strong financials. We equal weight the positions generally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So we don't want to fall in love with a stock that runs up and gets to be too large of a percentage of the portfolio where if it gets hurt by something that's unexpected, it has a disproportionate impact on the portfolio. But it is good quality companies that have distinct advantages versus their peers.
Right.
Brand loyalty, niches, things that if I gave you...
I'm looking like Starbucks and Abbott and Cisco, Microsoft, Union Pacific, those kind of companies.
Yeah.
Well-known names, Diageo.
And, right. and those are companies that people love those brands
mm-hmm.
and they're going to be loyal to those brands. They'll be willing to pay a bit of a premium. We really like those type of companies that can weather a storm if we have a downturn in the economy.
Right.
And they're if you look at those brands, they tend to not be commodities that mm-hmm. are competing on price.
I'm thinking that what are some of the other volatility dampeners? And certainly, you know, we talked about bond ladders. We talked about some, you know, very solid dividend paying stocks that it's such as are in your dividend strategy. What about, cash? What about treasury bonds? What about REIT?
You know, the thing with cash is it's actually starting to earn a measurable return.
Right.
You know, and it's getting close to inflation, which mm-hmm. is good. It is, when you're looking at dampening volatility or managing risk, you can avoid risk, manage risk, and transfer risk. And cash is a risk avoidance strategy. It's, you know, it's liquid. You're not going to earn over long periods of time a rate of return that net of the taxes is going to exceed inflation. So your purchasing power will erode, and it's death by a thousand little cuts. You know, mm-hmm. Each year over time, it's worth buys a little bit less, a little bit less, and that's manageable. You know, it's worse. It's not as bad as a big hit.
Right.
You know, we have global equities, because if you look at the price earnings ratios on international equities versus mm-hmm. U.S. equities, you know, there's a fair spread.
Right.
You know, same industry, a car manufacturer.
No, Europe, for instance.
Yes.
Right.
So those are things that rebalancing your portfolio.
Right.
Looking at historical relative valuations on things that you own. And when one of them gets outsized, rebalancing back to that weighting will naturally sell high, buy low.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things that are all disciplined, structured, mechanical things that everyone knows they're supposed to do, like drinking eight glasses of water a day mm-hmm. and getting a half hour of cardio in that nobody does.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey, my stocks are doing great. Bond yields are bad. Why am I going to do that? The U.S. is doing well. Internationals.
Right.
I'm not going to sell this great performer to buy this dog. Well, you know, those are things that are wonderful for producing better risk-adjusted returns, dampening volatility.
Mm-hmm.
They're just counterintuitive, and they require a lot of discipline to execute.
When do I instigate the fire drill plan?
I think it's 3 to 5 years before you retire.
Okay.
That we start doing that. And
so maybe we should do it just as a matter of course. I mean, just, you know, should everyone, if they can, plan to work part-time or not withdraw the full 5% from their retirement funds? And
I think that
I mean, is it just,
I
that's
think,
just the way we should do it 5 years in and it, 5 years
I think the answer to that
before.
Question is going to be unique to each person. The most important thing that we hope to get across to clients when they come to talk to us, whether they choose to work with us or someone else mm-hmm. or do it themselves, is that this is a very different sport with different rules mm-hmm. and different skill sets.
One investment for a long-term diversified portfolio, what should we all own some of?
I think that a you know, broad-based, globally diverse portfolio. So, you know, if we're going to...
Stock portfolio? Balanced portfolio?
So I think that a cornerstone of someone's portfolio, having a, you know, broad 60-40 mix that has U.S. and international, large and small, as well as domestic and international fixed income as a cornerstone
mm-hmm.
and something that you can build off of. But I think that is a good, solid foundation for someone. And most of the big brands have a you know, cornerstone that they can use
right.
for that.
All right. Mark Cortasso, thank you so much for joining us on WealthTrack. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Consuelo.
Thanks. At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's Action Point picks up on Mark Cortasso's dividend strategy. It is take advantage of the income and defensive qualities of dividend-paying stocks. One of my favorite personal finance gurus is Morningstar's Christine Benz, a longtime Wealth Track guest. Benz recently wrote two articles about dividend-paying funds and ETFs. One about dividend growers, which focuses on companies with a multi-year history of increasing their dividends every year. The other article, which I am reporting on today, is about dividend yielders, companies whose priority is paying generous dividends with high current yields. The article is titled Three Funds with Tantalizing Dividend Yields, and they are indeed, in this case, better than 2.75%. First on the list is Schwab U.S. Dividend Equity ETF. It carries a silver analyst rating from Morningstar, and it focuses on the higher yielding half of the 2,500 largest U.S. stocks, excluding REITs. It emphasizes not only companies that have consistently paid dividends over the last decade, but also score well on various profitability measures. The second name is their only actively managed fund. It is Vanguard Equity Income Fund. It also carries a silver analyst rating. As Benz notes, it is run by two separate management teams plying complementary strategies. One team is from Wellington, which finds dividend-paying companies that appear inexpensive relative to their growth prospects. The other team is from Vanguard, applying a quantitative approach. Benz's third pick is the Vanguard High Dividend Yield ETF. Also rated silver, Benz says it avoids the big sector bets normally found in traditional high-yield funds like financials, utilities, and energy stocks by the way it weights the portfolio. These three funds combine higher quality companies, defensive characteristics, and those tantalizing dividend yields Benz was looking for. Next week, we turn our attention to finding global growth prospects. Artisan International's Mark Yockey joins us for an exclusive interview. In this week's extra feature on WealthTrack.com, Mark Cortazzo shares why mentoring new hires is so important to his firm's culture and success. An important part of our success is connecting with you on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. Thank you for engaging with us. Have a super weekend and make the week ahead a profitable and a productive one.